Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined once again on the podcast by Martin van Staden. Martin, thanks for coming on again today.
Yeah, no problem. These conversations always get very interesting, so I'll be here as often as you need me.
Excellent. And also we have Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you?
I'm well. I hope to make Martin's 30 minutes interesting. Help him make it.
Indeed. Well, I know the pressure's on now. I'll also have to do my best. But first, we must start off with some admin. We are very happy to once again be sponsored again by Bitwise. And Bitwise says, we all know that Bitcoin is the best performing asset of the past decade, and many people are accumulating Bitcoin as a strategy to hedge themselves against fiat currency debasement and government overreach. The guys at Bitwise have developed their latest product, SatStacker, to help you accumulate Bitcoin over the long term. SatStacker allows you to set up a recurring purchase order directly from your bank account that then accumulates Bitcoin for you at the frequency and amount that you choose, depositing the Bitcoin directly in your own self-custody wallet. There are many use cases for SatStacker, from simply automating a weekly purchase of some Bitcoin for your own personal stack to setting up a long-term investment fund for your kids. Accumulating Bitcoin in automated regular amounts has never been simpler, safer, and more convenient. Try out SatStacker today. And we thank them very much for sponsoring us. There will be a link to that product in the description of the show. And the other thing, of course, to note is that today and tomorrow, the IRR is in KZN. Tonight, we will be at the Midlands Fable in the tap room at 85 Curry's Post Road near Howick at 6 o'clock. So come along there and join us if you'd like to meet some of the crew. And tomorrow, we'll also be in Umhlanga at 6 o'clock at the Garden Court in Umhlanga, at the corner of Aurora and Centenary Boulevard, in meeting room floors 1 and 2. So come and also see us there if you're in the Umhlanga area. So let's get into our first story of today. And this is, I think, probably the big one in the mainstream news. And that is regarding investigative journalist Jacques Poe's new book. So Jacques Poe is set to publish a book called Our Poisoned Land, Living in the Shadow of Zuma's Keepers. He originally wrote a book called Zuma's Keepers, which detailed a lot of the corruption of the Zuma era. The book is only being launched tomorrow and is a sequel to his previous book. Sorry, my cat is meowing loudly in the background. And one of the many tidbits contained in the book are some accusations about EFF leader Julius Malema. It reportedly says that Malema has had alleged dealings with tobacco trader Andriano Mazzotti, including hosting lavish parties and allegedly receiving cash envelopes from Mazzotti. This has caused outrage amongst the EFF, who, according to the publisher of Jacques Poe's book, NB Publishers, they claim they have received a letter of demands from the party's lawyers, the EFF, that have been saying that both Jacques Poe and the publishers must unconditionally apologize to Julius Malema, Floyd Shivambu, Mr. Ndlozi, and all other members of the economic freedom fighters for negligent and malafide publication of untrue, unverified, defamatory allegations pertaining to those parties which publications have been unconditionally withdrawn and not republished either now or in the future. The publisher says that they stand by their author and will continue to publish the book. They say that all of the information was properly sourced and lawfully published, and demands for its removal have been rejected. Jacques Poe said he was ready for a legal fight in an interview, saying, quote, I suppose the next step will be for Malema, Shivambu, and whoever in the EFF to sue me for defamation. In 2 years' time or whatever, we will head to court and fight it out. We believe we have good evidence. We believe both Malema and Shivambu have a case to answer. Responding to the allegations in the book, also on radio, an EFF spokesperson said that Jacques Poe was a drunkard who writes lies, that brandy and coke inspired him to write the book, and that we cannot have in the history books of South Africa a recollection of such low base petty gossip being presented as fact. So there's, I just want to, before I go on to you guys, there's a particular sting for those who may not know about Jacques Poe there, why they're calling him a drunkard specifically. And this is because Jacques Poe wrote, I think it was an opinion piece on Daily Maverick, talking about how he had been mistreated by the cops and a restaurant owner and such things, and then it emerged later that he had just sort of been a bit drunk and disorderly, and that it wasn't really the case, what he had written in his piece, and he had to sort of retract it and apologize for it. And that, for a while, I think that hurts his credibility. And you can see how the EFF is really targeting that now. So, sorry, let me start with you. The point I've just kind of been thinking through my mind is, like, you know, this is exactly why important journalists doing important work need to be very careful to protect their reputations.
Well, first, let me say that Jacques Poe and his publishers couldn't have got better publicity prior to the launch of this book if they'd paid for it. Because, well, we're talking about it, and we're talking about it the first item on the show. And yes, Jacques Poe, who has had a very good reputation as a journalist, a very experienced journalist, but it's been known for some years that drink is a bit of a demon for him. And he wrote this piece, and it was false. And, you know, it obviously tarnished his reputation. He essentially disappeared for a couple of years. It is for that very reason, although it may be used by the EFF to try and tarnish him, I may be a bit naive, but I very much doubt that he would have written a book that would be published that wouldn't have gone through every media lawyer's grubby mitts before it was released, and that the research wouldn't have been anything but immaculate, because he's vulnerable.
Exactly. And considering on how publishers, or not publishers necessarily, but, you know, corporate South Africa is so ready to bend the knee to the EFF, especially after the whole Clicks thing. I can't see the publisher backing him unless they were also sure that they were going to win anything in court.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, after what happened with him, there's going to be a certain sort of caution. But I think he would have made sure that he sort of resurrected his position with a properly researched, properly written book. I may be wrong, but I very much doubt it.
No, I definitely tend to agree with you there. Martin, it's really interesting to me how vicious the reaction has been from the EFF. It's clear that they've seen some sort of advanced copy of the book, because it's only coming out tomorrow. And yet they've immediately got this lawyer's letter in. They say that the thing needs to be completely taken off the shelves. It can't be talked about at all. That it's all just lies, lies, lies. They're trying to get out the head of the story. Do you think that if the story becomes sort of widely accepted by South African people, that it will really hurt Malema's chances? And is there any chance of some of the accusations here being widely accepted by the South African electorate?
I have my doubts. I'm not sure that EFF supporters specifically care too much about this type of thing. I mean, we had the VBS saga a few years ago, and it rolled like water off their backs. The EFF has been at the forefront of, I think, various other scandals, not least of which is genocidal rhetoric. I don't think the type of person who would actually go out donning a red beret and voting for that party really would care about what they would no doubt term the accusations of a privileged white man. So I don't think it would necessarily hurt Malema electorally. However, it's clear that from the nature of the party and the nature of the man calling himself a commander in chief and making speeches saying that all threats to the revolution must be eliminated, that of course they would touch a nerve, and of course there would be a reaction like this. I'm actually quite surprised that they didn't go and sack Jacques Poe's house, given, as you say, its previous previous.
The story's still early days.
Yes, yeah, no, it might still happen. I mean, it's the EFF is certainly not a party to underestimate when it comes to violence. I think from a purely reasonable perspective, the appropriate response would be to refute his claims. I know the Democratic Alliance does this incessantly, as the media accuses them of things and then they issue explanations of what the real state of affairs is. But I somehow doubt that the EFF or Malema is going to be able to go into the detail of why what Poe says is false, because currently if Poe has, I guess, proved a prima facie case, if you want to put it in lawyer speak, then the burden shifts to Malema and to the EFF to say, but it's not so. I would be concerned if I were them, because in their lawyer's letter, they say that Pau's remarks are negligent and mala fide. Now, if you've studied an LLB, the basic degree in law, you'll know that it should be negligent or mala fide. You can't be both malicious and negligent. You have to choose one or the other. So clearly, there is a little bit of haste among the EFF's lawyers, so they'll need to up their game. But I mean, as Sarah said, this is just great for the publishers and for Pau. And someone commented on Facebook yesterday, wondering, isn't the publisher or PAL maybe arranging these things with the EFF, the controversy, getting it stirred up in the background to push sales up? I mean, that would be a very smart marketing strategy. I think this book is going to sell very, very well.
Yeah, they've apparently even attached to the book the phrase, "The book Julius Malema doesn't want you to see." I'm not sure if I agree with you that it won't have much of an electoral effect. So I think that there's a certain core of EFF supporters, you know, anywhere between 5 and 10% of the electorate, that, you know, sort of around what the half the EFF vote to the current entire EFF vote, which is really baked in and for the EFF. They buy its racial nationalist program, they buy its socialist program, all that kind of stuff. But I think there's a lot of people who are sympathetic to the EFF and who are maybe a little bit interested in the EFF or may have voted for them in the past, who voted for them because they thought the EFF were the corruption busters. They were the people who were taking the fight to Zuma. And I think the VBS scandal, it's been a little bit confusing how it's been reported in public, but to have a whole new one come out and be fought possibly in court, and maybe with some dramatic stunts where, I don't know, maybe there'll be some drama at Jocpo's book launch or something like that. I can very easily see the story kind of beginning to percolate through the body politic. It'll become one of those things that people sort of know half the story of. They just know that it's bad. And I can't but think that that kind of thing will probably hurt Malema in the long term, which is precisely why the party is striking as hard and as early as they can on this book, in the hopes that they could maybe even just nip it in the bud before it grows into a narrative about him. I don't know. Sarah, what do you make of that?
I think given those two different categories of EFF supporters, I think what it may assist to do is at least not grow the EFF's portion of the national vote. And that in itself would save us all a lot of pain and anguish.
No, very much so. And I think a lot of the polling has actually suggested that. We haven't seen the EFF growing astronomically despite the ANC's catastrophic numbers. And I think that's because a lot of voters, those who aren't already on the train, so to speak, are kind of looking at this going, I don't know about this. I don't know about this anymore. Anyway, it's definitely something to watch. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more drama around this story in the next week, but keep an eye out for it. And I look forward to the book and what it's gotten it to see if he's examined everything and what he says about Malema. Right. So in the pre-show discussion, I said, Eskom's in a lot of trouble. And Martin laughed and said, no, are you serious? And the reason for that, specifically at the moment, is that there's a whole mess of stories about Eskom that are just like, it's difficult to imagine the situation as being much worse at the moment, apart from the sort of total collapse of the system. So let's just go through a couple of the stories I've seen recently on Eskom. One is that the head of generation has just quit. He said that there was a critical need to achieve balance to the benefit of his family, of his health, family, and work responsibilities in his resignation letter, and that the pressure was unbearable. Sounds like he was probably on the verge of some kind of nervous breakdown, which I'm not particularly surprised by, because I think being head of generation at Eskom is a really awful job. City Power, which is, of course, the power utility that sells power in Johannesburg, says that it is going to be short by, I think, 300 million rand from its budget because of all the load shedding means it can't sell electricity to customers. And there was a story about the Medupi power plant, which is, of course, one of our new power plants that was supposed to, these massive coal power plants that were supposed to end load shedding, where according there was a hydrogen explosion relatively recently there, and according to ESCOM, that's going to take 2 years to fix. They've also fired the two people responsible for it, who they claim were deliberately deviating from maintenance procedures. And lastly, and this is the story that I think we'll focus on a bit more, is that ESCOM says that it is no longer able to run the open cycle diesel-powered turbines. These are the big turbines that they use to keep the country off of load shedding. They add another extra, I think it's 2,000, 3,000 megawatts of power to the grid. They run off of diesel fuel, which is extremely expensive to keep shipping in. And ESCOM has already spent in 7 months of this financial year, 12 billion rand, when they only budgeted 11 billion rand. So they say that for the next 6 months, there is likely to be a lot of load shedding because they can no longer afford the diesel for the generators. Martin, what do you make of all this?
Look, I always bring it back to what I think is the source of the problem. And I think that getting lost in the detail of it gives ESCOM an easy out. Getting lost in things like tender corruption, getting lost in all of that. The problem is that South Africa is not expanding its energy capacity, and saying that we are doing so with wind and solar is simply not, it's not viable. When you have people like André de Ruyter going into the media, going to conferences, saying, forget about coal power. I think he also made similar remarks about nuclear power. Forget about it, effectively, what he says, because you won't get funding for it. You won't get approval for it from government. So all eggs in the renewables basket. That is effectively ESCOM saying that we are in a managed decline. We're not even trying to solve the problem. And one must not forget that even when you think about renewables, President Ramaphosa announced to much fanfare in late July that ESCOM is going to develop feed-in pricing tariffs for people to sell power back into the grid from houses, from businesses, from their solar panels. It seems like ESCOM basically said, thank you, Mr. President, your opinion has been noted, but we will not be doing that, because since then there has been no publication of any feed-in pricing structure, and therefore this solution cannot be implemented. So Vietnam, for instance, I think solved about 10% of their load shedding crisis through a feed-in system where ordinary people sold back into the grid. So I'm not sure that ESCOM is really, or the leadership corps there is really interested in solving the problem. I know that they always say that there are political pressures and so forth, but that hasn't stopped them before from making quite controversial statements about BEE and so forth. Nothing is stopping them from saying, listen, we need coal power, we need a lot more coal power, and we need a lot more nuclear power. Our hands are tied, we can't do it, but that's what we need, that's where the solution is. Nothing is stopping them from saying that. They're not saying that. They're saying we need to go with the green agenda. And to me, that just seems like we don't have good help in this context. And I think Sarah mentioned earlier that it's probably gonna have to get a lot worse before it's gonna get better. And I think that's probably true. I don't think it's really stuck yet for most decision makers in South Africa, that we need to significantly expand coal and nuclear power. And the usual excuse that it takes decades to build these things is not true. We are very close to the People's Republic of China. And if we get a bunch of engineers and would one call them workers or slaves from China to come and build us a huge nuclear power plant in about 5 years, it's doable. It's perfectly doable, but I don't think the ANC wants to upset the polite Western European circles who are insisting on green power, as we discussed in yesterday's show. So yeah, we're between a rock and a hard place, but ultimately someone needs to stand up and say, we need coal power and we need nuclear power.
You know, I think I actually even slightly disagree a bit there, in that to say that I think in many ways the problem isn't necessarily the source. It's just that, you know, I mean, that's definitely part of it, but the management is just so bad. We did have these two big power plants, Medupi and Kusile, built, and they should have helped, but they didn't, because every every level of the whole process was just botched. You know, it was expensive, ran over time, the maintenance, you know, things keep going wrong, so stuff blows up. Casilla's having like major breakdowns, and it's not even all online yet. Mm. They still have to put the like sixth generator on. So you kind of think, you know, we've almost reached a point where it doesn't matter what inputs we put in, because ESCOM's management and skills base and all of that is so poor that we get very little out the other end. I don't know. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, as Martin said, I think we've actually reached a stage where we've gone so far and haven't persuaded government to really act with any urgency, with any clarity, with solutions. The private sectors, you know, those things that are coming on stream from the renewables, I mean, good grief, you know, that's not going to touch the problem. And the other problem, of course, is the fact that you've got the whole world at COP27 buying into renewable energy, and we all know that it if we're lucky, it'll be a drop in the ocean compared to the rest of our energy needs. We can't just, and it's this sort of chest beating and tub thumping that goes on with our government. I mean, at the end of the day, I put it squarely on the ANC and the ministers. I read an article yesterday, it may not be true, but the many articles that one reads about ESCOM is that it's not the aged infrastructure as such. That can be overcome, that can be managed, that can be fixed. It's the fact that you need a decent supply line of the materials you need for repair, and B is it has to be properly managed and done, which means people have to be fired for incompetence or retrenched because they are obsolete. Until the ANC is prepared to get to that point, we are just going to carry on going through this almost charade of appearing to try and keep energy going. Let's put it this way. Probably the biggest mistake the ANC has ever made is that, unlike China or Korea or a whole lot of our countries, they just didn't know when the corruption should stop and the doing something for the people should start. Whereas those countries, they're all significantly corrupt, but they knew that their corruption, their ability to be corrupt and maintain their corruption, depended on actually building the power plant, putting the electricity out, building the bridge, whatever it may be. The ANC has not done that. The ANC has taken the view that what's theirs and ours is theirs, and they've got they're paws into absolutely everything. So consequently, they've overshot the mark, and I think we are going to have something will have to happen significantly, and like it isn't significant enough, but really significantly, for the ANC to say, we need all the help we can get, come and help us, those who can, those who know, and get rid of the people who can't. It's just unfortunate. That's how successful businesses work. I mean, look at the tech sector in the United States. It's hit that non-profitable status, or their profits are going down. So Elon Musk, Facebook, Meta, the whole lot of them, Google,
Amazon too,
are retrenching.
No, exactly.
That's how things will stay afloat, unfortunately.
Martin, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, it just occurred to me that that you said that they fired the two people who they fought caused the... the implosion of whatever at Kusile. Yeah,
the hydrogen and explosion.
Yes, it's like, my goodness, you'd think that that something more than mere firing them, going to court, at least on delictual grounds, would be at the very least.
To be fair, they did say, I think they had handed them over, or they had opened a case or something with the law enforcement.
Okay. Okay, now that's fair enough, but
who knows if that'll happen.
But the issue is that the previous strike, I think this was in July or in June, ESCOM announced very seriously and sternly that they would take disciplinary action against the strikers. But the second the strike ended, it was quiet. Like, you heard nothing more, again, about the apparent action that they were going to take against the strikers. They don't want to fire people. I mean, Sarah is entirely correct. There needs to be mass retrenchments at ESCOM specifically, because they went on a hiring spree in the early 2000s for no reason other than to meet employment equity targets. I believe that's their own admission, that their ratios, their racial ratios were out of sync, and then they had to appoint more people in a certain racial category to meet their equity plan. I mean, obviously, thousands of people working at ESCOM now need to go, and it doesn't seem like there's an appetite for that. And as Sarah says, it's only when the government reaches that point of no longer buying votes with jobs, I guess, and realizing that it's unsustainable, that we can actually probably get out of this issue.
So, this is going to continue to, I think, be in many ways the central crisis in the country, on top of our other central crisis, which is unemployment. But, of course, the two go hand in hand. Okay. We don't have too much time to put on here, but let's just talk very briefly about the Land Court Bill. So, Martin, you put out on behalf of the IRR today a media statement about the Land Courts Bill. I believe it's going through the National Council of Provinces at the moment. Do you just want to refresh us on, firstly, what the bill does and maybe why we're not so enthusiastic about it?
Yeah, very briefly. So the Land Court Bill creates the Land Court. It's a new court with the status of a High Court, which effectively replaces the old Land Claims Court, but more than that, becomes the specialist court for all land-related matters. So there's the land reform, this will be expropriation, land claims, etc. Anything that really has to do with fixed property will now be going through the Land Court. Now, I mean, in principle, that's not a terrible idea. Specialist courts are things that countries often need. The issue that the IRR has with this bill specifically is that you have to take into account the broader context of the very toxic discourse around land in South African politics, and how that filters into what the bill says. Now, there's lots of bad things in the bill, but the two big things that stand out is that, firstly, it's watering down the rules of evidence. It allows the court to admit hearsay evidence and oral evidence, even though, and the bill says this specifically, even though that might not be allowable in other courts. So there is the first warning sign. The second one is, like other courts, this is not abnormal. This court is allowed to appoint so-called assessors, effectively South Africa's answer to a jury system, who sit with the judge, two very silent people on both sides of the judge, who help the judge effectively come to determinations of fact. Now, the judge has the final say in determinations of law, but as a bench of three, if there's a question of fact, the two assessors, if they agree, will be able to overrule the judge. And the bill says that assessors do not need to be legally qualified, but as is practice, they have to be kind of experts in this case, land matters. Now, our worry there is that the so-called experts on land reform and land matters in South Africa are very likely and very unfortunately going to be land activists, people who get into this toxic political discourse, who claim that they are experts on this topic of historical dispossession and all these things which are real. But the type of people that are associated with that discourse and who pass as experts on that discourse are the types of people, unfortunately, who won't stand to defend South Africans' private property rights. And as Dr. Anthea Jeffrey said in our initial submission, the biggest threat this bill, read with the expropriation bill and other pieces of legislation that the government is proposing, the biggest threat is posed to the emerging black property owning class, which really only after apartheid ended, for the first time, got access to fixed property. So they are still the most vulnerable class of property owners in South Africa. And when legislation like this crops up, they stand to be the biggest losers. And that is why really the Institute and all proponents of free enterprise and property rights should really read between the lines, even though some of the text of the bill is benign and say, listen, we see that there is an ulterior motive here. You want to water down private property rights. Let's rather not to do that. Let's uphold property rights and create prosperity for everyone.
Sorry, very briefly, your thoughts.
certainly can't add to that. It's a good summary of a pernicious piece of legislation that is very politically agenda driven, very ideologically left wing. And the irony is, as Martin says, you'll end up with people who should be have title to land, not having title to land. I mean, it's just from a classical liberal point of view, it's unthinkable.
Indeed, indeed. Anyway, the fight continues. We will see you all tomorrow on the Daily French Show. If you're near Howick, check us out at that address that will be in the comments. And if you're near Durban, check us out tomorrow. We'll be in the area. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, and we'll see you soon. Cheers.